Welcome to the History of Witchcraft. Episode 5. I have forgiven the devil. As to the affairs of the witches, which your grace thinks brought to an end before this, it has started up afresh, and no words can do justice to it. Ah, the woe and the misery of it! There are still 400 in the city, high and low, of every rank and sex, nay, even clerics, so strongly accused that they may be arrested at any hour. It is true that, of the people of my gracious prince here, some out of all offices and faculties must be executed. Clerics, electoral councillors, and doctors, city officials, court assessors, several of whom your grace knows. There are law students to be arrested. The prince bishop has over 40 students who are soon to be pastors, yet among them 13 or 14 are said to be witches. A few days ago, a dean was arrested. Two others who were summoned have fled. The notary of our church consistory, a very learned man, was yesterday arrested and put to the torture. In a word, a third part of the city is surely involved. The richest, most attractive, most prominent of the clergy are already executed. A week ago, a maiden of 19 was executed, of whom it is everywhere said that she was the fairest in the whole city, and was held by everyone a girl of singular modesty and purity. She will be followed by 7 or 8 others of the best and most attractive persons, and thus many are put to death for renouncing God and being at the witch dances, against whom nobody has ever else spoken a word. To conclude this wretched matter, there are children of 3 and 4 years, to the number of 300, who are said to have had intercourse with the devil. I have seen put to death children of 7, promising students of 10, 12, 14, and 15. Of the nobles, but I cannot and must not write more of this misery. There are persons of yet higher rank, whom you know, and would marvel to hear of, nay, would scarcely believe it. Let justice be done. Johann Brandt, Chancellor of Würzburg, in a private letter to a companion in 1629. A single innocent person, compelled by torture to confess guilt, is forced to denounce others of whom she knows nothing. So it fares with these, and thus there is scarcely an end to accusers and accused, and, as none dares retract, all are marked for death. Friedrich Spee, confessor of Würzburg and author of the Cautio Criminalis. Welcome back to the History of Witchcraft. Last week, we heard the tragic and bloody stories of the witchcraft trials at Fulda and Bamberg. The trials of Fulda began at the turn of the 17th century, instigated by Prince Abbot Balthasar von Dernbach, who had recently returned to his seat of power after 25 years of exile. The trials were taken up with fervour by Dernbach's right-hand man, a former stablemaster called Balthasar Nuss, who reportedly oversaw the interrogations of suspected witches, invented new methods of torture, and asked for specific people to be denounced by the suspects. These exploitative actions left the Hexenmeister, as he was titled by Dernbach, open to punishment once his ally and protector kicked the bucket. And Nuss was imprisoned for over a decade as the new Prince Abbot investigated his actions. Found guilty, Nuss was beheaded on the same hill that he had sent so many hundreds to die on. In Bamberg, we had a similar case of fear and panic leading to many hundreds of deaths, but with some differences. In Bamberg, the Prince Bishop, Johann Georg Fuchs von Dornheim, has no notable underling to take the blame for the trials. Dornheim is centre stage during the trials of his reign, and whatever responsibility the authorities had over the massacre is therefore lain at his feet. This week, we'll finish our travels through Germany with the deadliest trial of the period. The series of persecutions that took place between 1626 and 1631 in the Franconian region of Würzburg. Over the last few episodes, we've heard of Würzburg quite a few times, mostly due to the political and ecclesiastical links between the bishopric and its neighbours. For example, during Balthasar von Dernbach's exile, the Prince Bishop of Würzburg, Julius Hector von Mespelbrunn, ruled the Abbacy of Fulda alongside his own territory, only relinquishing the seat after the combined pressure of the Pope, the Emperor, and the Aulic Council of the Empire was brought to bear against him. Dernbach's nephew would serve at Würzburg, later ascending to the Prince Bishopric. Bamberg was once under the authority of Würzburg, and the city of Rottenburg ob die Tauber once answered to the Prince Bishop on all religious matters. Würzburg is an influential player in the region, if not the empire as a whole, and it is little surprise that this influence would continue during the height of the witch trials. Speaking of the witch trials, like the events at Bamberg we discussed last week, the trials at Würzburg began after a sudden winter storm in 1626 destroyed the region's fields and vineyards, ruining the harvest that the populace relied on for food and trade. Also like the events at Bamberg and other trials we have looked at on this show, they rapidly got out of hand. The most prominent individual in this story is, unsurprisingly, the Prince Bishop of Würzburg. And just who was the Prince Bishop of Würzburg at this time? Well, we will actually be looking at two Prince Bishops of Würzburg. The first was a name that we've heard before, Prince Bishop von Mespelbrunn. Now, Mespelbrunn had a meteoric rise, even by the standards of the noble clergy. Born in 1545, young Julius enjoyed the finest education available, travelling to schools in Mainz, Leuven, Paris, Pavia and Rome, among others. At the age of 22, he took up the role of canon of Würzburg, which sounds like a young age for such an important job, but since he was appointed to this role in 1554, when he was 9, if anything, he's been a bit of a slacker. 3 years after moving to Würzburg, he became the Dean of the Cathedral, and 3 years after that, young Julius became the Prince Bishop Julius, at the ripe old age of 28. He was promoted so quickly that he wasn't even ordained as a priest before he became a bishop. It was 3 years into his reign that Prince Abbot Dernbach was forced into exile, and Mespelbrunn immediately moved in. Until Dernbach's return, Mespelbrunn zealously continued the absentee abbot's policy of counter-reformation, which I'd imagine would be quite disappointing to those that instigated the coup. This policy was undertaken in his legitimate territory of Würzburg as well, and Mespelbrunn is held up as the refounder of the city's university, and his sponsorship of the Jesuits was held up as an example for other Catholic rulers. As to be expected from a zealous ruler who demanded orthodoxy, he was not the biggest fan of witches, and once wrote that he wanted to see witches burn all Tuesday. Not sure why Tuesday in particular, maybe that was just the day he had nothing to do. Despite this, according to historian Robert Mayer, until 1600 there are no recorded executions for witchcraft on Mespelbrunn's watch. There were subsequent witch trials in the second half of his reign, but nothing on the scale of his neighbours in Fulda. When Mespelbrunn died in 1617, he left behind a staunchly Catholic province. The second Prince Bishop of note for us today was Philip Adolf von Ehrenberg. Ehrenberg was a member of a noble family, and like any noble family worth its salt, they had connections. Particularly important to us was the familial connection with Prince Bishop von Mespelbrunn. Mespelbrunn was young Philip's uncle, and what good was a powerful uncle if he didn't get you a good career? Which is exactly what he did. Ehrenberg was elected his uncle's successor's successor in 1623. Having been raised in his uncle's household, it is understandable that the new Prince Bishop would share some of Mespelbrunn's views, namely his determination to see his territory purged of unorthodoxy in all of its forms. It is therefore little surprise that, after the harvest was destroyed by weather, Prince Bishop Ehrenberg decided that the cause was witchcraft, and ordered his officials to begin rooting out the culprits. The trials at Würzburg led to the deaths of an estimated 900 people over 5 years. As with all things to do with casualty figures, take this number with a pinch of salt, but I've seen it repeated elsewhere by multiple historians. A list of sorts has been preserved, detailing executions within the city until February 1629, and it details the occupations and some of the names of the 157 victims. Now, this list is only detailing the executions within the city boundaries, and up to a certain point, so historians believe that it is also incomplete and inaccurate. However, nevertheless, the lack of detail about these people is somehow more haunting. I'll read out a few of the entries. 4 strange men and women found sleeping in the marketplace. Gobel Babelin, aged 19, the prettiest girl in town. Baunach, the fattest burgher in Würzburg. Steinnacker, the richest burgher in Würzburg. A wandering boy, 12 years of age. A little maiden, 9 years of age. A maiden still less than 9. Her, that is to say the little girl's, sister, their mother, and their aunt. 14 vicars of the cathedral. The wife, the 2 little sons, and the daughter of the councillor Stolzenberg. The striking thing about the Würzburg trials is the sheer number of children that are accused of witchcraft. Not just young adults or teenagers, but prepubescent kids. Too young to realise the consequences of their confessions, and certainly too young to withstand torture or to defend themselves legally, a tragic number are recorded as being burnt at the stake. On the Facebook page, I've posted a table found in Middelfort's seminal work, Witch Hunting in Southwestern Germany, which breaks down the number of executions between 1627 and 1629 in male, female, and children categories. Some groups executed count more than half of their number as children, and the ratio of male to female victims begins to even out. Middelfort describes this thus. Slowly, age and sex came to matter less, leaving society with no protective stereotypes, no sure way of telling who might be, and who could not be, a witch. End quote. This collapse of protective stereotypes was a force multiplier for the witch panics. Not only did this amplify the fears of those leading the persecutions, making them more zealous in their persecutions, but it also meant that their net was much wider. An example of this are the dozens of Catholic priests, both in Würzburg itself as well as its surrounding countryside, that were accused of witchcraft and executed for the crime. Perhaps a good example is how easily historians of the Stalinist terror, such as Robert Thurston, can transition to studies of the Würzburg trials. Now, obviously, they do not compare in terms of numbers killed or geographic range, but the atmosphere of paranoia and fear is apparent in both. As the letter I read out at the beginning of the episode states, several hundred citizens of Würzburg were at risk of arrest at any time in 1629, simply due to their being denounced. Replace Würzburg with Moscow, 1629 with 1936, and you have some strong similarities. There is a particularly tragic story that I'd like to cover, and it begins at a neighbouring city of Würzburg, Merkelsheim. A wealthy merchant and magistrate, Bernhard Reichhardt, has sent his only son, Johann Bernhard, to school at Würzburg, whose educational reputation was greatly enhanced from the sponsorship of the prince bishops. As the trials progressed, and Würzburg became famous for the sheer number of witches found within its walls, Reichhardt became convinced that his son had been seduced into the witch cult by his fellow students. In an effort to purge his son of this suspected heresy, Reichhardt arranged for young Johann to be transferred to the Jesuit school at Dettelbach, a few miles to the east of Würzburg, where he would be safe from any corrupting witches. Despite this precautionary measure, in March of 1628, the Würzburg authorities believed that the young boy had been involved in witchcraft, and they wrote to the administrator of the local Teutonic Order chapter, Johann Kasper, to request his assistance in extraditing the poor lad. Young Johann was handed over at the border, and was officially subject to the jurisdiction of Würzburg by the end of the month. Just weeks later, on the 8th of April, Johann had signed his confession, stating that he had been seduced into witchcraft by a classmate. Now, I don't know whether torture was used in this case, and to be frank, it would have been easy to coerce Johann into admitting anything since he was only 9 years old. Torture had been used on children younger than him, and would be again, but in either case, the boy confessed that, among other things, he had denied God as his Lord, Christ as his Saviour, the Virgin Mary, the saints, and the angels. He'd also written, in his own blood, Ich, Johannes Bernhardus Reichhardt, hab mich dem Teufel vergeben. I, Johann Bernhard Reichhardt, have forgiven the devil. He also admitted to having flown to numerous witch sabbats, and at these gatherings he had sexual intercourse with the devil. I just want to repeat, the lad is only 9. When asked to describe the devil, it is little surprise that he did so in terms similar to adults, that the devil was, quote, hard as iron, and had, quote, a cold nature, end quote. Then, as expected, Johann gave the names of 3 other people that he had seen at these sabbats. A month later, the tragic and yet expected outcome occurred. Johann Bernhard Reichhardt was led out of his prison alongside 4 others and burnt at the stake. He was 9 years old. His father only found out about his son's arrest after he had been burnt at the stake. Johann Kasper, the Teutonic administrator that handed the boy over, agreed that the penalty was fully justified. Children continued to be suspected of witchcraft for a variety of reasons. Some claimed to have had met the devil, learned from him, while others sang indecent songs about the Virgin Mary and the saints. At almost any other time and place, these actions would be written off as childish antics caused by an overactive imagination, or at worst, a desire for attention. If they deserved punishment, it would be corporal rather than capital, the lash rather than the noose. Not in Würzburg, and not at this time. One impoverished child joked to his friends that he would willingly serve the devil if he fed him, clothed him, raised him, and gave him a pony. He was hanged and burnt for this idle blasphemy. It was not merely the children of the poor and those far away that were suspect. Ehrenberg is infamous for his treatment of his own nephew. Said to be a rebellious child, the boy was denounced in the interrogation of his friend, and he was subsequently provided with a vast array of teachers and tutors from the Jesuit schools in order to purge his sinful behaviour. The Prince Bishop probably considered himself merciful in this matter by staying his hand when others would have been convicted straight away. Nevertheless, his patience ran thin, and the boy was eventually treated like any other. That is to say, he was arrested, tortured, and then executed. While Würzburg was the site of the most extreme trials in European history, there was significant opposition to the persecutions, most notably from the confessor of Würzburg, Friedrich Spee. Spee had been a Jesuit since 1610, and had worked and studied at Trier, Fulda, Speyer, and Mainz, among other places, before arriving in Würzburg. Now, what do these places have in common? Oh yes, that's right, witch panics. Now, obviously Spee had avoided the worst panics at Trier and Fulda, due to not being in the business at the time, but he may have been in the area when trials erupted at Speyer and Mainz, and we know for certain that he was at Würzburg during Ehrenberg's persecution. He would later pen the furious tirade against witch trials, the Cautio Criminalis, or the Precautions for Prosecutors, which he published anonymously out of fear for his life. While not disputing the existence of witchcraft, he condemned many aspects of the witch trials that he had personally witnessed, particularly the use of torture. Spee asserted that, after years of acting as a confessor to condemned witches, he did not believe a single one had truly been guilty of the crimes for which they were to die. What impact the Curcio actually had on the witch trials is difficult to say. Middlefort argues that his, quote, pragmatic, legal approach was ultimately more effective, end quote, than, for example, Johann Weyer's radical polemics. Because Weyer attacked one of the, quote, crucial intellectual foundations, end quote, of the trials, that of the Satanic Pact, he, quote, irritated witch hunters more than the practical and essentially legalistic criticism of Spee, end quote. Either way, Spee is credited with convincing the Elector of Mainz to end all trials in his lands in 1647, and his work was widespread in the following century, when witch hunts were once again isolated incidents rather than all-consuming panics. The end of the Würzburg trial is estimated around 1631, but the reasons for this are debated. Middlefort rather takes the point of view that it was due to Prince Bishop Ehrenberg having an epiphany in 1630, after both himself and his chancellor were denounced by convicted witches. The fact was that he knew he was not a witch, but would be liable to arrest had he not been the Prince Bishop, and that might have sparked a moment of clarity. Maybe all those people I had executed were in the same position. According to Middlefort, Ehrenberg prohibited all further trials and established regular memorials for those who had been wrongly executed. While this does seem somewhat plausible, there are contradictory reports that trials continued until the bishop's death in 1631, and the subsequent occupation of the city by Swedish forces, similarly to events at Bamberg. In either case, the Würzburg trials took the lives of an estimated 900 people, and exhibited levels of barbarism seldom seen in other persecutions. The sheer number of executions, especially considering how young so many of the victims were, will forever mark the Würzburg witch trials as an example of what happens when fear, paranoia, and zealotry combine. Thank you for listening to this episode of The History of Witchcraft. If you've enjoyed the episode, please consider leaving me a positive review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whichever podcast app you use. You can visit the website at thehistoryofwitchcraft.co.uk, where you will find my contact details if you have any questions. The show also has a Facebook page and a Twitter feed if you want to keep up to date. The intro and outro music have been provided by Sounds Like an Earful. Thank you again for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.